which I had this problem once before, but I guess the amount of times that we've used this line to have two problematic days is not too bad. But we could always use a cell phone in the future, too. All right.
Did you have trouble because of the snow and ice?
No, I'm not sure why.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure why.
Okay.
But this the cell is working fine.
Okay. Good. Okay.
This is the speaker over here. It's this way. All right, so we are up to, let me see. All right, everybody still there?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so we're up to now. Let's just do, we're going to start verse 3, but let's just refresh. So we said basically that the benefit of the wise person is that he knows the understanding of a matter, the interpretation of a matter. And that's because everything requires interpretation since the world is created. We're talking about reality, as Francesca pointed out. Since what he's talking about is who is like a wise person, the first thing you have to address is in what capacity? What is the measuring stick that we're using that the wise man comes in first? So that's the question you have to address when you see him saying, who is like a wise man? Well, like a wise man in what way? See, you see that it's not in the verse, but you're forced to raise that issue. And then when he gives the answer, and he says that he knows the matter, and who is like, meaning he rephrases the question, and he says, what I really mean is, who is like one who understands the matter? So that means in terms of perception and interaction with reality. And so that's why interpretation. If you're saying that who is in terms of a builder, well, you wouldn't say the wise man is the best builder because perhaps he didn't study the specific area yet. And the one who has the experience will know more about different types of wood and so on, and cement and steel and structure. So when he says that really the wise man, that there's no one like him, so when he qualifies and says that it's regarding understanding the interpretation of a matter, that means perceiving reality accurately. And the reason why you need interpretation, again, is because since God created everything, so this amazing, this brilliance that we barely penetrate is, by definition, very deep. And just to look at something on the surface and say that a tree is branches and leaves without understanding why it's designed a certain way and what the coverage is for and why it's necessary that it goes through cycles of growth and then it loses its leaves and so on without looking into it and understanding the concept of why there's a branching type of effect. Something's a trunk and then it breaks its one and then it breaks off into maybe three or five independent shoots, and from there they grow taller and outward. And why do they grow in an outward fashion? Why do they just grow completely vertical? So all of this requires interpretation. Otherwise, the person is not really comprehending the real essence of tree, and that applies to everything. So that was his opening remark, which laid the groundwork. And then he said the second point in that verse was that wisdom of a person. Of the wise man, it illuminates his face, and we explain that to mean that it offers a person the greatest happiness, which makes sense because he's reaching the purpose, the objective of why a human being exists, is to have the greatest existence, and that's defined by happiness. So the person is not using wisdom in his life, so then he's going to be tremendously frustrated because he's not using the part of himself that can really give him the capacity of happiness that he can really attain. And he a person inherently is looking to be happy. He senses that, but he's misguided in terms of all his different pursuits, and he believes what other people tell him and what the masses perpetrate. And once he finally gets into the area of wisdom and can enjoy it, he starts to see a fulfillment that he never had before. So that's number two. And there is a struggle, though, in life, because there is a human nature of ego. And a person is going to want to satisfy that, because that innately gives a person a certain imagination or fantasy of greatness. And the ego is something which is very powerful. So because of that, he brings that in and he says that wisdom will alter the brazenness of a person's face. Right? The O's pano yishuna. The brazenness of one's face, the ego, the arrogance. That is something which wisdom can work with. And the reason why he mentions it is number one, because that's essential. In terms of the pursuit of happiness, there are obstacles. And that's one of the major obstacles is the person's search for self-aggrandizement. Once he's involved in wisdom, what happens is he starts to see something which is so much greater than himself. And so the brilliance, it's just amazing. And even the greatest minds, like Einstein, he said something of the nature that he sees it as a tremendous brilliance that's running the universe, a mind. And he was just in awe. And this is Einstein, who one of the biggest minds of our generation. So this causes a person to remove from the search for the ego, which just constantly needs to be built up time and time again. One dinner where you're the guest honoree, is not sufficient after it's over. Then what happens next week? The week afterwards? Then you're not in the limelight. So a person has to, it's a tremendous struggle. It's frustration. There's tremendous highs and lows. And that's not really what a person's built for in terms of happiness. So wisdom itself will also address that, because he will see something greater than the self. He'll lose the focus on the self. And like we said last week, when the person is searching and involved, is engaged in pursuits outside the self, that's when the person's really truly satisfied. When the energy has a place to go, which is unlimited. The person can only put so much energy into the self, and they get frustrated. And then he has a certain sense that people maybe are now going to start despising him, because look, he's chasing after honor. And like the rabbis say, the one who chases honor, honor runs away from him. Because people recognize that that's very, very shallow. The person has to hide his pursuit for self-aggrandizement. So what he does is he gives tremendous amount of money to a worthy cause, and now really he was just interested in elevating the self, but he couldn't do that. He just goes to somebody and says, hey, you know, bow down to me or praise me. It's despicable, like Haman said to Mordechai. But so a person will fool himself by giving large sums of money to great causes. And although that's a good in and of itself, we are suspicious of the motives why the person is doing that. Okay, so he lays the groundwork. King Solomon lays the groundwork by telling us that really, you know, after we've gotten so far in the book, that no one, in terms of appreciating reality, which is what life, which is what his book is about, what should a person do in this few decades that he's alive in order to really attain the goal for him in terms of his creator's objective? Well, that's to be involved in reality, number one. And that's the wise man who could understand and unravel, because you can't just look at the surface material. And it will give you great happiness as a second point. And the third point is that it will also combat one of the greatest foes that we have in our life, and that's our ego. Now he moves on. And he says, I, the word of the king do I guard, and on the words of the swear, of the oath of Elohim, of God. Meaning he guards both. The word guard is applying to both. The words of God, meaning the Torah, the commands, as the commentaries say. And also in terms of the oath that we took, as Sforno says, that we accepted upon ourselves the Torah with the punishments and rewards. So we suggested last week that why is he saying he changes appellation for God. One case he calls him king. Another case he calls him judge or justice. So what he wants to tell you is that the king is really the one that knows best. How does a person come to the power of king? So he, hopefully, the king is the one that has the best in mind for the people, and he knows the best for them. But now we're talking about God, so certainly God knows best. So King Solomon is trying to tell the reader, if I'm following God, that means to say that I, the wisest person next to Moses to live, am suggesting that you should adhere to the system of Torah that he gave us. I'm guarding it because the system itself is from the king. It has to be the best. He's not qualifying the previous statement about that it enlightens a person's, it illuminates a person's face, and it removes him from being involved in arrogance, brazenness. But now he explains to you because it's from the king. And there's also another aspect, though. The oath, which we took with blessings and with curses, I mean, there's punishments. That's something where he now refers to God as the judge, because that's also something which we have to give an accounting for. So he brings in that as well, that not only is it a good, but there's also an accounting that you have to give for yourself. So again, he's stressing the importance of the Torah system for both the positive and from the negative. In terms that it's a system that's designed by the king, it has to be great. And again, this is explained in the previous verse. How come it illuminates the person's face? Well, the answer is, look where it's coming from. The creator gave it. So therefore, by definition, it has to be the greatest thing. But keep in mind also that there is, see, a person is rebellious. So he has to talk about the second part of the verse, that he also guards the oath, and he keeps the commands, and he's concerned, his consternation about the violation of the Torah system. Okay? So just, you know, it brings out, it fleshes out more. We just touched on that last week. Alright, so far so good? Let me just stop here. I just wanted to just review, just bring us up to speed.
Wondering about the ego that I know that it's a word, it's an emotion that you have to stay away from, but like at what point, is there any, I know that it should like give some good, it should serve some good for a person because God created it.
Yes, I mean, person has to have interest in preservation of the self. And there's a certain equilibrium, there's a certain dignity that a person has, but even that is forego, you know, a person foregoes that at certain times when he's in need. But I guess we have to do a study in terms of the complete spectrum of you know, human psychology. And what are the primary functions? What are the primary needs in a person for preservation? Again, the goal is to perfect the self and to be in line with reality and to have the greatest relationship a person can have with his creator. To be in the best state. And I could see, I mean, there's definitely cases where ego is important, that a person can use his backbone to instill fear or the proper education as children and as students. So a self-assuredness is necessary in those cases, for sure. But he doesn't abuse it. The rabbis condemn a person who instills too much fear unnecessarily in his congregants. So that's a real crime. Then you're just abusing. But there are times where it's necessary that the person evokes or invokes that part of his personality, but it's more of a display. It says also that, you know, part of what ego does is that it gives a person the ability to display anger. Now, that's one of the two traits that a person is never supposed to display, ego and anger. And you see, they are related, because anger is where you put yourself at the center and you don't want to accept. We talked last week. It's the inability to accept reality. So therefore, anger is an expression that I want something to change. But it is necessary. Rambam says, at the same time, that you're never supposed to give in to ego or to anger, whereas every other trait, it should be in the the equidistant from the two poles. So don't be too greedy and don't be overly charitable. You have to be in between. Don't be too giddy and don't be too morbid. Be in the middle, because when you're equidistant from the two poles, that's when they have the least amount of strength. And as Rebbe explained, that's when the both ends of the spectrum have the least amount of strength. We gave that example of the ball bearing between two magnets. If you put it right in the middle, the ball bearing won't move. If it's slightly to one side or to the other side, you'll start to see it to roll and then pick up speed until it gravitates to the point where it attaches to one of the magnets. That's basically the two poles of the emotion. So that when an emotion has a pull on us, the intelligence doesn't. So the way you get to the point where you're guided purely by intelligence is where you stay in between the two poles of any given emotional spectrum. Then your intelligence is free to reign 100%, except anger and ego. But my mind is just saying that any wise man that does not take revenge like a snake, he's not a wise man. So there he doesn't mean that the person is really sensing arrogance and taking revenge. It means he's displaying something in order to educate. It's not a real sensation. He's just using that to show a lesson to somebody. I remember there was a story once, I think it was during the Holocaust, where a number of the Jewish leaders came before, I'm not sure if the president or somebody, the high American, government, and they all were giving different reasons, they should step in, this and that, and one of the Jewish leaders just started crying, and that really got the American congressman the strongest. Sometimes the emotion is really what's necessary in order to achieve a good. So same thing with a teacher, same thing with anger or with ego. It's necessary at times for the student, because the student is still young and still is impressed by that. And that will be affected at that stage in his life. So there's another purpose for ego. All right, Naomi?
Yeah, good.
Okay. I'm sure there's plenty of other cases. I'm just off the cuff. Okay. Now. So now he moves on. So now we're up to verse 3. Everybody else, anybody, any other questions? Before we start a new verse.
Good to hear.
Okay. All right. So now he goes on. It's a little bit cryptic. And he says, do not be excited to go from before him, meaning to leave God's presence. Do not be excited to leave from before him. Do not stand on an evil matter. For all that which you desire, you do. Okay, now that's a little bit, who's that talking about there? Ki kol asher yachas, all that he desires or that is desired, yaseh. Is done or he does. You have who is the Swarno translation there? No, just the verse, not the Swarno.
Oh. You mean Swarno's translation?
Well,
just the actual English translation of the verse itself, not the commentary of Swarno.
All right,
so it sounds like he's talking about God, all that God wishes he will do. Okay, so it's all talking about God. Right, that's for sure. The beginning where it says, do not be excited to move from before God's presence. Don't stand on evil matter. And the way you have it at the end is that for all that he, God, desires, he does, or he will do. Okay. Cryptic, to say the least, and also how does this fit into the series of verses here, the context? What's going on? That's the most important. But of course, we have to get the just the plain explanation. So, seems to be saying that a person should not be excited to leave God's presence. Sounds like he's going against God. And then he says, don't stand on an evil matter, which would seem to follow, that if you leave God's presence, you're not following God, so then you're going to be engaged in something which is evil. The last part is a little bit funny. For everything that he desires, he will do. What does that have to do with you? The first two things were about you leaving before God's presence and then being involved in something which is negative. And it doesn't sound... Yeah.
So in those kinds of verses where he's using a pronoun, Calvin's pointed out that he has the stone addition of Tanakh, and they do not capitalize the pronouns. How is there a way in the Hebrew to know whether a he is referring to a person or to God, or is it just all contextual?
I think it's going to be contextual. It's the same word that's going to be used. Like he could be God or he could be the person. And I think there is a dispute amongst, you know, either Sforno or Ibn Ezra here. I'll read them to you. They have very divergent explanations to the verse. But let's start off by asking a question. What is he saying? You should not be excited to leave before God. What? The first word that catches your eye in the verse is excited, right? So what is excitement? Let's define just what excitement means. Good, right. When you move, you're motivated by some emotion. You're overpowered, an emotional overpowering. But the rabbis say that man is excited or worried regarding his money. That's one of the usages. Here he's saying that do not be excited to leave before to leave God's presence, so to speak. Let's take Ibn Ezra. No, we'll go slow here. And he says, he goes a little bit in terms of explaining that you really have to accurately explain this, you have to reword it slightly, just in terms of the grammar. And he says examples. Like, for example, where it says in the Torah, V'neda'a nirdefa, and we will know, we will chase after. Another one he says, is another quote, he says, do not increase speaking. So he says the real essence of what this means is that they knew in order to chase after something. And that's what I think that's regarding knowledge of God in that case. And in the other case where it says do not increase to speak, he means al tarbu, do not increase lidaber, in order to speak, meaning you shouldn't increase in your speech. He's just modifying the words. So he's applying it over here too, because he says it's a little cryptic. But he says even more correct, really, with the way you should understand this, is that it's really missing the word that. It has to be put into the sentence. And the way it would be explained is if we say, and it was known, or we knew, that we should chase after this. Or the other case, a person should not increase, that he should speak. Evidently, speech was not a good thing, and as a person had what to say, or he didn't have the right wisdom. So he was speaking before he thought about it. And then he says also over here, he means to say, do not be excited from before God that you should go. I mean, don't be fast in your heart that you should think that you know to leave from before the face of the king, lest you stand on an evil man. Excuse me? I got feedback. Everybody still there?
It's Rabbi.
Okay.
No. Yeah.
Okay. No, I have feedback. I know somebody's trying to ask a question, but...
I don't hear anyone else. I hear you.
Okay.
Okay, good.
All right, so what it means is over here is that a person should not be very excited to leave before the king. Meaning to say, don't think in your heart that you know a matter. That you should consider that you should leave from before the face of the king, lest you stand on an evil matter that's evil in his eyes. But then he says at the end, he says, he cared so no, because in accordance with his will, yuchal la'asos l'cha, he is able to do to you, which sounds like a punishment, which makes sense then. So his point is that a person has a certain amount of excitement, and this can now be displayed in this connection. When a person is confronted with Torah, so now he says that there is this possibility that a person will be excited to leave before the king. What does it sound like he's doing? And then he says, lest you stand, and maybe you get engaged in something which is evil, and then God has the ability to do what he wants with you. I mean, he can punish you. But what's his main point over here in terms of what's the phenomenon he's describing?
Rabbi, I'm having a difficult time understanding the him and Ezra, but as I look at the verse, what I seem to be understanding is that people get things in their lives that they want to do, and so the time they spend in Torah study and prayer or whatever becomes secondary to them, and they hasten away from that so that they can do those things that they do want to do.
All right, good. So they're putting their agenda before the Torah agenda. But it's an outgrowth of an excitement, meaning that it's not thought out. But there's another thing here. It's not just any area that a person is now rebelling against. It's specifically when he's confronted with the Torah, is what I want to bring out to you. Because he's not saying that a person shouldn't be excited before his friend, or be excited before when he's on a vacation, or the excitement that he's describing here is where he's before the king. Right, atipahel mipano, before him. Don't be excited before him, because what he's describing is that there is a rebellion when a person is confronted with the Torah. Obligation breeds rebelliousness. That's what I believe the primary message is giving over here. Do not be excited before him. You should leave his presence. He's not talking about leaving the presence of any other pursuit in life. He's talking about one, abandonment. The abandonment of when the obligations of Torah devolve upon you and you realize it, be aware. And this is not so different than the last thing he said in verse 1, where he says that the brazenness, the Torah removes the brazenness of a person. It's the same thing. We're talking about arrogance. So one aspect is when a person learns and he's engaged and he sees the wisdom, the natural arrogance is now tempered, and it's removed from a person, and he comes away with an awe and a respect. But there's also another thing. There's in terms of when obligations, so that's in terms of wisdom, but the Torah doesn't just give wisdom, there's also obligation that is thrown upon all humans. And what can happen is that the person will have a natural reluctance. And that's how Rabbi Chait explained a statement of the rabbis. The rabbis say, greater is one who's commanded and does the Torah. He is better than somebody who wasn't commanded. Now you'd think that's counterintuitive. You think, who's a better person? A person who's not even commanded and he does it. Let's say like a Noahide, and he takes on a new command. That's outside of the purview of the dozens of the laws. I mean, I know there's seven categories, but like you discussed with me, you told me, I think it was Doug who said that there was a book that talks really isolates about 60 or so laws. So a person would think that the person that does not have the command and doesn't, he's on a higher level. But Rabbi Chaya explained, no, it's just the opposite. When a person is commanded and he fulfills, so he has to fight the rebelliousness. Because that's what happens when a person that has a natural tendency for one thing. What's the natural tendency that the person has that creates this problem?
Desire to operate in accordance with his emotions.
Right. Basically freedom. He wants to be free. And when you make an obligation upon a person, that stifles that desire just to be free. That's a big argument that people hold, I'm doing what's good, The people who are not observant, I'm a good person. They try to justify it. But really saying is, I don't want to be told what to do. And this, every other area of life, what's important to them, they will go to, for example, health. They won't inject anything into their bodies or take certain pill or combinations of pills or do surgery on themselves. Of course not. Because they look at the body as really being, that's far and above everything else in life. So they are going to go and listen to exactly what the doctor says. They don't say, I know better in that case. But when it comes to the soul, a person just does not see the gravity of that. And he will make decisions and say, listen, don't tell me what to do. Person has that natural freedom. Hopefully, using the example of a doctor, we can reach people and we can show them it's a foolish statement. That God's telling you this is the best thing and he built you, he designed you, then you should be as concerned, if not more concerned, because now you're talking about your soul. You're talking about your eternal existence as opposed to just your temporary physical existence. So you can pull that out from this verse when he says a person shouldn't be excited from before God. Well, so you got to stop and ask. Why is it that before God the person's excited to leave his presence? So you'll answer the question. Now you see clearly, because that obligation causes a person to want to rebel. But where does the rebelliousness come from? It comes from the primary desire for freedom, just to do what I feel. But that is ego again. I want to do what I want. You can hear those. You can sense that emotion when I say that. Leave me alone. Let me do what I want. It feels good. A person has that certain confidence, but it's a false confidence. He wouldn't say that. Say the doctor tells him to take X, Y, and Z, procedures. He wouldn't tell the doctor, hey, let me do what I want. So he's, again, what King Solomon is doing here is vocalizing certain workings of the emotions that are going to be touched upon, because he just said that I'm going to follow the word of the king and I'm going to and I'll be responsible because the oath of the judge, and you see he uses judge because now he's talking about punishment. King knows best, so you see it's important to understand the usages of the terms. What reference are we using for God? He changes the reference right in the same verse. All right, so I just want to point that out to you. Okay, so that is Ibn Ezra's explanation. Sforno, completely different explanation. He says as follows. He says, do not be excited at the multiplicity of all the commands, at the numerous commands, and then leave from before God's presence. And he says, Kamokain, Al Mipanov Telech. Do not leave from before God without pondering the reasons for the commands, in a manner that you should turn to fulfill them. And even, I think a sense over here, what I'm going to ask you is, do you have a sforno on 3? Who has the English sforno? Doug? This is a difficult...
No, I don't have the English sforno.
Oh, you don't have it in English, okay. Well, what I think he means here is that, let me just, one more second, we'll try to do this together. Do not be excited by the numerous mitzvahs, I guess, that seems to be, it's overwhelming, and then you leave from before God's presence. On the pun of Telech, do not leave from before God. Built the Hisbonin, the Tame Mitzvos. without pondering the reasons for the commands in the form, in the manner that you should fulfill them. Bilvad. Meaning that you should perform them without the understanding. I'm not sure, I tell you the truth. I'm not sure if he's saying that you should be careful not to abandon the mitzvahs unless you understand them, because you already accepted them in this way, or if he's saying that you should certainly look into them to understand the reasoning. But the bottom line, he says at the end, is that the fact is you've already accepted the Torah system in this way, meaning that was something which we took upon ourselves. And then he says, further, don't stand in an evil place or evil matter. He says, do not remain with this thought that's evil, that God gave the commands without any reason for them, and there's no objective. That's kol shiachos, because he did everything he desired, meaning there's a will, there's intent, there's purpose behind it. So maybe he's saying earlier that don't abandon the system because you think there's no reason to it. Maybe he means to say, do not leave God's presence, meaning don't abandon fulfilling the Torah system because you don't see any reason in the commands. And he says, don't stand in this evil place, meaning don't remain in this wrong thought. I think that's what he's saying. Don't reject the Torah because you just can't answer all the different mitzvahs that you see there. Don't stay with this evil counsel, because God did everything with intent. There is reason. A completely different explanation than Ibn Ezra. But you see, saying this now because he just told you, verse 2, that after explaining how great it is that it's the wise man that really understands and can interpret reality, and it lightens his face, and it removes his arrogance. But then he says, because the system is given by God, and there's, on top of that, you're held accountable. But that's something which now is going to generate a certain amount of rebelliousness. Both of them seem to be saying that, like the verse says, everybody's agreeing, do not be excited to leave from before God's presence. Both Ibn Ezra and Sforno are explaining that's what it means to leave, but what's the reason why you're leaving? Is it because you think you have some idea which is better? Let me see if Ibn Ezra says that. Seems to be Ibn Ezra saying that do not be quick or excited in your heart that you can really leave from before this. The responsibility is with you, it sounds like he's saying. You can't escape the responsibility. Sforno is saying to... Also, you're not going to follow the Torah system, but the motive here is because you think, I don't see a reason behind it. So it's a way the person justifies himself from leaving it. And, or like people say today a lot of times, oh, you know, this is archaic. It doesn't apply anymore. Like as if God didn't know what was going to happen in the future. So people say today is a foolish statement. Oh, these are old laws. They don't apply anymore. What do you mean they don't apply anymore? You think God didn't know that they should be applying for all time? He knew the future. He knows what's going to happen 1,000 years from now, too. And yet he said the Torah is eternal. Well, let me stop here. I think somebody had a question.
I do.
What was that?
With the new lives, we have, you know, 7 categories, which translate over to maybe 60-some commandments. And most of those with the possibility of one surrounding eating a living animal are reasonably obvious, you know, in terms of the rationale. So let me take a Jewish person. So you've got 613, as I understand it, about 400 of those have to do with things specific to the temple standing, so the practicality of today is more in the 200 range. But beyond that, you have lots and lots of detailed rabbinic commandments. Now, possibly. I'm looking at this from the standpoint of when it wasn't written in this, so maybe that's part of the answer. But a person couldn't possibly know and understand all the reasoning behind each one of those that he's required to perform on a daily basis. At the same time, you know, my understanding is that this Torah approach is that we're supposed to operate in accordance with our mind. So I'm kind of wondering how those two get balanced, because it would seem to be, in some senses, not a useless gesture, but a questionable gesture to be doing all kinds of commandments that I either haven't had the time to study, or for whatever reason they just don't make sense to me, as opposed to doing something where, you know, I understand the reasoning behind it. Am I making sense with the question?
Yeah, it sounds like you're saying that it's beyond our ability to really understand every single command, but we're supposed to, at the same time, follow things based on reason. So if I haven't had the chance to study what I'm practicing, how can I fulfill living a life that's reasonable?
Yeah, to take it even further, I mean, some of the commandments, it seems, and particularly I'm thinking the rabbinic realm, which is problematic for Noahides, and I'll explain why in a minute, that there could be so many that a person could get so caught up in analysis paralysis of, you know, do I do this, do I do that? I mean, if you, in almost any kind of a system, it seems if you invoke so many rules, a person gets to a point where they can't move because they're so worried about doing something wrong that they, you know, end up just frozen, if you will, like a deer in a headlight.
Well, getting paralysis, that's not a healthy state. And that's, the Torah doesn't suggest that. A person is definitely supposed to build. Let's take an example. A guy is making a building, so he starts laying the foundation. Next day, the head contractor comes over to him and says, how come you're only working on the basement right now? How come you don't have the 100th floor finished already? So the builder should not feel bad, because he knows that he can't get there that fast. He is doing everything properly, though, so therefore he feels, he explains to the head contractor that you have to start here, and the steps, and I can only be addressing whatever is, you know, I can. I sleep 8 hours a day, I'm eating 1 hour a day, so that leaves me with, 14 hours left to actually do that. I have to spend time with my family 4 hours, so it's 10 hours, so before it's said and done, I'm putting 8 hours a day on making the building, and I can only get this far in that 8 hours, and everything I've done up to this point is done with levels, done with the right cement mixture, the right foundation, the right beams. So he's rest assured that the time that he put into what he developed so far was in accord with reason, and he doesn't feel bad at all that the head contractor blamed him for not having the 100th story built yet, because he knows, although that is what is the objective, but he knows that there's a process, and you can't rush the process. It's impossible. You can't do 10 hours work in a span of 8 hours. So same thing with the Torah system, or Noachide Jew, whatever it is. So the person is studying, he understands, and he wants to see the reasoning why I do the morning prayers, all right? But he still has to say the afternoon prayers in 3 hours. So what does he do? He hasn't had a chance to study the afternoon prayers yet. But he doesn't feel bad, because he knows that he sees after a certain amount of time, the system is giving off tremendous wisdom. He has a confidence in the system. He knows for sure that it's created by God. He's past that. He understands Torah from Sinai. He understands all the basic proofs. So he knows that Judaism is the only true religion. And he's already had a taste of the process of study and how things make sense. So, all right. So I don't have the answers yet for what I still have to practice. So, and he's not worried. Also, there's not this state of I'm worrying I'm doing something wrong. The person studies. He knows what he's supposed to do in the positive sense. So he does it. If he learns that he had a mistake, so then he addresses it. But he's not worried without cause. That's not warranted by reason to be worried I can sit around all day being more of a maybe since I just studied the whole Torah. Maybe, you know, what I'm doing right now, I shouldn't do. I can't function that way. If I do find out that I have something misconstrued or there's a new law that I'm going to learn that really, let's say, for example, I'm wearing a blue shirt and I learned some law why I really shouldn't be wearing a blue shirt. Once I come across that law, now I know. I'm not going to feel bad that I did it unknowingly because I'm not responsible for that. I was doing what I should be doing. I'm studying at a certain pace, and I'm trying not to waste any time. So God knows that the person's living at the pace that he can. And when he comes up with new things and he incorporates it, he does it on a step-by-step process. So there shouldn't be any paralysis. There shouldn't be the worry. Because on the other hand, you can say, well, maybe you won't find out that you're doing something wrong. So worrying is really, it's just an emotion. It really doesn't have any basis. It's coming from, I think, a certain amount of, compulsion. I mean, compulsion is also part of our framework. So we have to identify when we see a certain compulsive tendency, and there's no, in a certain, in many areas, it's not going to be good to be involved in that. But we should identify it and understand just reasonably, what does God expect? What can I do as a human being? Certain amount of hours in the day, and the rate that my specific mind works. So you have to assess that. And I think if that's done properly and truthfully, a lot of the other, the concerns will fall away.
So in a case like that, then when a person like that gets to Yom Kippur, are they obligated to repent on that which they did not do because they weren't far enough along to be able to?
No, it doesn't make sense to me. Because he wasn't doing it maliciously. It wasn't like an ignorance where it was his fault. There's actually a verse in the Torah that says the hidden matters are to God, but the revealed matters are to us to be accountable for. So my assessment would be that that's a hidden matter. A person didn't know. Like, for example, there's a Talmud in the seventh chapter of Sabbath, and it talks about the level of culpability for a person on breaking the Sabbath. So if he was, let's say, raised among heathens and didn't know anything about his Jewish roots and so on, so for all the Sabbaths and all the laws that he broke on all the Sabbaths his whole life, he only has to bring one sin offering. Just one. Even though there were thousands of laws that he broke and hundreds of Sabbath days that he violated. But let's say, because it's in line with his ignorance, so his fault was only not knowing the existence of Sabbath. So because there was only one flaw, so therefore he's only one accountability. But you see that God doesn't hold him accountable like me. I know about Sabbath. I know about a lot of these laws. And now if I break them, I'm going to be held accountable for every single one. Because now I have greater knowledge. So you see that Talmud, that Talmudic Kershon, illustrates how culpability is something which is in proportion to knowledge. So accountability is not the same for two different people.
Okay, that's helpful, thank you.
Yeah, does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Right.
It's at the very beginning, if you want to take a look, of a Sabbath, the seventh, I think it's the seventh chapter. Okay. Is there a class with Rabbi Moskowitz today?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, we do.
Yeah. When does that start? At half an hour?
Let's see. 12:45 Eastern.
12:45 North. Okay. All right. So, but you see how these verses now, just going back, you see how they follow. There's a context, and you see how King Solomon is, the verses are related. And you see how when he says, don't be excited from before God, that teaches you, well, you have to ask the question, why should a person be excited to leave before God's presence? Well, because it's one thing that presents that nothing else does. being in God's presence means having the law in front of you, and that is going to cause a rebellion. Because of, and where does it come from? It comes from ego. And he just talked about the ego in the previous verse. But you see, the person, the cure to the ego, the person learns. When he learns and he sees more and he sees how good it is, he's going to have less and less of a rebelliousness and more of an attachment. And there still be maybe, you know, maybe certain spurts of energy or rebelliousness that a person will still have through his life. But again, you know, we're humans and we do have emotions our entire life. And, you know, that's what's the concept of tshuva. And, you know, a person, what he does is he tries to contemplate and see where he went wrong and what was the emotions. And you see, when we, in Yom Kippur, when we talk about all the different forms of sin, so one type of sin is where we did a crooked, an act of crookedness. We just weren't staying straight. Another type of sin is where we were just like a wanton, uncontrolled type of an expression, a different emotion that caused a sin. Or we missed the mark, a different type of an expression of a sin. So there's many facets to, you know, the human mind. If we identify them, they become less unconscious, they become something more that we're aware of, and we can control. You can only control that which you know. So that's what's important. And you see what King Solomon is doing, is isolating that in this instance. That rebelliousness is naturally going to fly in the face of an obligation that's put upon you. Because of that ego, because of the desire to be free. So now a person should stop and say, well, why should I really want to be free from something that's good for me? I wouldn't want to be free from the doctor's advice. So try a person, if he can fly it here, so he may still have that tendency just to do what he wants, when he wants, eat when he wants, and so on and so forth. So he may have the tendency, but as he can bring it under control more and more, the emotion will have less pull. There has to be a routine, that has to be regularly, you know, reviewed. And like the rabbi said too, the more you starve an emotion, the more full it becomes. So, I mean to say, the further you are from giving into an instinct, the less of a pull it has on you. It's like it's satisfied, it doesn't need. But if you feed an instinct, just the opposite happens, it gets hungrier. The more you aggravate it and you give satisfaction to any instinct, so that's how much more you're going to. It's just like a person takes drugs. And the more he takes, the more he needs the next time to reach that same level of the high. It's the same illustration. Okay. All right, so let's shift to the next class. So we did Sforno, and we did Ibn Ezra. And maybe we'll do is we'll pick up and we'll see what the other commentators say on this verse and see how it goes. You can start seeing now how it flows into the next verse, which is what we'll do next week. We'll do verse 4. All right, it continues on the same. But I think now we see how the flow, we see where he's going. All right?
Sounds good.
Sounds good here, too.
Okay.
Thanks, Rabbi.
My pleasure. Okay, so everybody have a good week. Look it over. And
okay.
And we'll pick up from here. We'll just review the other commentaries next week on 8.3, and then we'll go to 8.4. Okay, so have a good week to everybody. Sorry it took some time about the delay today. Hopefully the phones will be working good next week.
All right. Thanks, Rabbi.
Okay.
Thank you, Rabbi.
My pleasure.
Yeah. 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 Don't tell me. I'm on the road.